Okay, let's get rolling. Welcome. Can I just say that it is extremely heartwarming to see like every seat in the house filled for a C++ session. Thank you. I'll applaud you. It's fantastic. I was talking to Bruno earlier, and he noticed that of all the language sessions, there are very few of all the other languages, and there's a number of C++ sessions this year, which kind of speaks to what I'm going to talk about, this idea of a C++ renaissance. And I've got a ton of stuff to talk about, and I've got a bunch of demos I want to show. What I'm trying to do is kind of give you a taste of why we are where we are in C++, what we're kind of doing about it in Visual Studio, and where we are in Visual Studio with this release, and show you some demos. I'm going to try and focus on the stuff that you can't get in any of the other sessions at Tech Ed Europe this year. So some of the things that hopefully you won't see anywhere else or hear about anywhere else. Bunch of interesting stuff driving this whole C++ renaissance. How many of you have heard this term being used recently, the C++ renaissance term? Yeah, so like handful of people, maybe a quarter of the crowd. And let's jump in. First of all, I thought it was important to define what is a renaissance. And I'll read it off to you. A movement or period of vigorous artistic and intellectual activity, or a rebirth or revival. And to me, it's a little bit of both. We're kind of doing both with C++, and there's a bunch of reasons why we're doing it. When we have this period of a renaissance, I started asking myself, okay, well, you know, there's a renaissance. Like, what's in a renaissance? What are the attributes of a renaissance? And I think all of these points are true about C++ right now. New creativity, new growth, new usages of C++. We're seeing a lot of new people on the stage as well in C++. It used to be kind of this old crowd that every year kind of got older that was leading C++, and they would, you know, every year they got a little grayer and their beards got a little longer. And now, like, there's some hotshot kids out of, you know, Facebook and Google, not just us old guys working at Microsoft that are really driving forward on C++. It's great to see. A bunch of new C++ projects happening, and I'll show you some data around this, actually. One of the things, this last point of teachers becoming students, that sort of thing, as I've talked to people that traditionally do, that are in the C++ business, you know, people that are trainers or they're part of the standards bodies or whatever, I'm finding that they're taking a lot of their cues from this younger crowd. And one of the other things I've been observing, just anecdotally, is that people that are kind of in the C++ business are really busy. Like, I was talking to Kate Gregory, and she does a lot of different things, but C++ is kind of one of her home bases. And she spent her whole year working on C++. Herb Sutter, who works on the ISO committee, he also works on our team at Microsoft, and good friends with Bjarne Strestrup, who's kind of the father of C++. Bjarne says he's busier doing C++ than he's ever been, according to Herb. And so, just kind of a fascinating time in our history. I think there are really four things. I think we can break it down to four things that are really driving the C++ renaissance. One is this new relevance of cross-platform. For a while, you know, cross-platform, very important early on. That's why we saw the growth of C and C++. A lot of it was about, hey, how do we get Unix on all this different hardware? It's kind of the definition of cross-platform back then. And yeah, there was some other stuff as well, but for a while there, we had a few, you know, kind of Wintel years that went pretty good for some companies. But now there are lots of different platforms that are very, very relevant, and people are using C++ to get at those things. In particular, mobile devices, tablets, phones. People are using C++ as their vehicle for cross-platform. Also, there's kind of a new expectation of experience. One of the interesting things, it used to be that, like, I could design UIs, like, you know, menus and buttons and list boxes and things, and that would be acceptable. But increasingly, like, that is just not acceptable today for professional-looking user interface. There's an expectation that it's going to be touch-sensitive, and there's an expectation that I can control things with gestures, and it's going to be three-dimensional, and I'm going to be, you know, all that stuff is less a novelty and more an expectation of how modern software works. And I think that will increasingly be an expectation, and C++ helps deliver on that, mostly through power and efficiency and being close to the operating system and the hardware. Speaking of hardware, there's a whole bunch of new stuff going on in hardware. You might say that creativity in hardware plateaued for many years, where the trick in hardware was kind of, okay, let's like increase the clock rate every year. And so software just got faster because computers calculated things faster. But of course, as we saw, kind of heat, power became a problem. Computers started to go multi-core. Heterogeneity is a bigger deal now with people doing compute on GPUs and other kinds of accelerators. And now, again, with mobile form factors, sensors are becoming important. And so all this kind of getting at all this hardware, exploiting the capabilities of the hardware, and doing it in a way that's friendly to battery, which is another fairly modern constraint, really important. And then finally, C++ just isn't as hard to do as it once was. I would categorize that as new productivity gains, but the new language standard, C++11, when you find a few, how many of you have had a chance to look at C++11 or even write some code that had some aspects of C++11? A handful of folks in the room. So what you'll find is like, you can go a pretty long while before you have to like declare something as a type star. For example, like you can go a really long while without having to do any of those things that contributed to what I used to think of as write-only code. Like you could write it, but then nobody could ever go back and read the code later because it was so obtuse. And now code is both easy to understand, high level of abstraction, but at the same time still enjoys the traditional benefits of C++ of being very efficient on the hardware. And a bunch of new things in VS, and I'll talk about some of this stuff as we go on. One of the things I wanted to do is share with you guys some data that our team gathered. So this is data around C++ developers. We did a series of surveys around C++ developers. Our team sponsored it. And this wasn't a huge survey. I think a little over 1,000 developers, 1,200 developers, something like that, responded to the survey. But it was, you know, relevant. And what we found is, wow, look at the age spike here. This is kind of people that are in their late 20s or early 30s writing a lot of C++ code. So, you know, there's this meme that C++ developers are like these old guys with white beards and suspenders and right, and it's just not true anymore. Like, maybe it was true, maybe it wasn't, I don't know. But whatever it used to be, it's definitely not true today. C++ is something young folks are doing. I call these people the hipsters. I don't know if any of you are here today, but this is when I think of people in their late 20s and early 30s. This is, for some reason, the mental picture that comes to mind. I'm sure that guy writes great code. So I found this chart fascinating. One of the things I found even more fascinating on this chart, though, was that guy at the top. He's 92. Somewhere in the world, there's a 92-year-old guy that writes C++ code.
It takes longer.
What's that?
It takes longer than
that. Yeah, that's right. He was waiting for something to build. He started in his 30s. So I guess the meme about the bearded C++ guy isn't completely untrue. But if you're going to be a bearded guy, at least you can be a badass, you know, Gandalf C++ developer. The other thing we looked at, by the way, is the average age of projects. So, you know, there was this other meme like, hey, are C++ projects these old pieces of legacy code that people keep dragging forward year over year? You know, like Windows, for example, Visual Studio, these are all old pieces of code that we, you know, we retool them, we improve them, but fundamentally, there's a lot of legacy there. And what we found is that half the projects in the C++ world, in our sample, are 4 or less years old. They're relatively new projects. The other half is certainly greater, and a good chunk, 30% of projects, are more than 10 years old. You can count Windows and, you know, some of Microsoft products in there. But wow, this was a fascinating piece of data for me. Like, people really are picking up C++ for new projects. And when they do that, what kinds of things are they doing? So this pie chart here shows, of those new, those 0 to 4 year old projects, what kinds of software are people building with new software? And so big chunk of it is games. 20% of that new software is people writing games with C++. That makes sense. Games like to be cross-platform. Games require high performance. People use game engines, which work really well with C++, so that makes sense. Engineering science is another 15%. CAD, scientific, that sort of thing. And then people just building frameworks upon which other people can build. That was another big chunk. And then the rest is kind of split up, but kind of half of all new software in C++ is gaming, engineering, or frameworks. Of those of you in this room, how many fit into that half? Interesting. So we've got a slightly different demographic. Let me do a little surveying. So what about business software? Oh, big chunk of people. Ah, that's fascinating. Okay, big chunk of people building business software. And what about, say, imaging? Handful. Okay, this is good to know. So good representation here of the wheel. One of the things that that we think about, since it's our job to think about C++, is why do developers choose C++? You know, it's like the airline thing. You know, we know you have your choice of airlines, and we thank you for flying with ours, that they kind of say when you land somewhere. And so, you know, that's the way I was looking at this. Like, people have their choice in programming languages, yet they're choosing ours. They're choosing C++. Why? And I find it breaks down to three reasons, primarily. You can throw a lot of stuff into these three reasons. One is closeness to the hardware. You can call this one performance. You can call this one control. There are a lot of ways you can characterize this. But basically, it's about people being able to get as close as they want to get to the hardware to provide whatever value they need to provide by doing that. You know, they need to manage exactly how memory happens. They need to manage exactly the execution streams that are happening on the CPU. They need the highest level of performance. They need the best battery life. That's all about being really close to the hardware. And typically what people are trying to do is one of a couple things. They're either trying to get the processor to idle faster. That means come up with the answer more quickly so your CPU can stop consuming battery. Or they're trying to provide a better experience, a more real-life experience, something that's more realistic, more immersive for the user. So that's one. The other one is cross-platform. This one's pretty straightforward. C++ is a standards-based language, and people trust it because it is, to be able to take that code and run it on multiple platforms. Now that we have this new C++ 11 standard, we're working really hard to figure out, okay, how do we improve our conformance? All the other compilers in the world are working really hard to figure out how they improve their conformance so that when you write some C++ 11 code, you can feel really good about the fact that you can take that from place to place. And again, cross-platform and mobile, huge, huge driver here. And then finally, there's compatibility. Sometimes people have large C++ code bases, and it just makes sense to continue moving those forward as C++ code bases. Sometimes people have an existing investment in their own knowledge, like they're really good at C++, and they feel like they can be very productive continuing to do that. The other one that's a little less obvious, but I find it's interesting, C and C++ are kind of like the lingua franca of programming languages. It's like when programming language A and programming language B want to interoperate with one another, what do they typically do? They talk in C. Usually not C++, but they'll talk in C because that's a very well-defined interface that people know how to communicate, or, you know, languages know how to communicate with one another. And so it's compatible with everything, including other programming languages. So dig a little bit more into mobile, because I assert that mobile is one of these big drivers of the need, the continued need for cross-platform. It used to be in the mobile and elsewhere world that what cross-platform meant is you would write some software once, and it would run kind of crappy everywhere. Like, it would look a little bit off, and it wouldn't look quite native. Java had this problem for many years, for example. While it was cross-platform, it never quite looked right anywhere. Sometimes you find GUI frameworks that kind of have this, kind of looks like its own thing. It doesn't really look like a Windows app, or it doesn't look like a Mac app. There's a new pattern that's emerged, though, that phones have really brought about. And that pattern is this. People will use the programming language that's native to the platform to write the UI, to write the things that connect closely with the platform, platform services, etc. If you're on iOS, for example, that's Objective-C. People use Objective-C for the Chrome and things like that. If you're on Android, that's going to be Java. And if you're on Windows, that's going to be C++ CX on top of WinRT. That's kind of the default, the platform programming language. But in addition to doing that at the top level, what they will, maybe top and bottom, what they will do in the middle is write cross-platform code. And they'll use C++ to write that cross-platform code. Or increasingly, even on the UI, they'll use HTML5 and JavaScript to write the UI in a cross-platform way, which is becoming an increasingly capable way to build UI, especially for business-oriented applications where there's not a lot of complex 3D, et cetera, it's a great way to go. So this is very, very common pattern now that's distinctly emerged in software. So what I say is that the best experience is this pattern. It's use the platform programming model, whatever it is, for whatever platform you're building, and then keep all your cross-platform assets as C++ or HTML JavaScript. And this really delivers the best experience because these platforms are all trying to distinguish themselves from one another by offering new and compelling platform services. You know, maybe it's around sensors or camera or GUI or whatever it is that the hardware devices are doing. The platform, the native platform operating system and programming API surfaces those things as APIs for the developer. You know, we're a long way from this world where, you know, basically we know there's a console, we know there's a keyboard, we know there's a mouse, and we know that that is the way that the user is going to interact with everything. Like, that's just not the world anymore. And so designing something specific for the for this world is important to delivering modern relevant applications. On Windows 8, Windows 8 means C++, Metro-style applications, if you want to use the latest and most modern platform surface area, using C++ CX, which is a set of language extensions that we use that help C++ developers adapt to WinRT, which is the API and ABI, the binary and the programming interface for Windows 8. Another interesting announcement came out last week. Many of you guys might have seen this. Windows Phone 8 will support C++ as well. So until Windows Phone 8, the phone experience was .NET, kind of a .NET C# experience. With Windows Phone 8, you will finally be able to take your C++ code that works across many platforms and take the Windows-specific stuff and run it on the phone, run it on the tablet, run it on a PC, run it on a server, whatever. It's DirectX-based as well. So as you're writing the C++ stuff, you can find, say you're building a game, you can have great source code compatibility between the phone and the Windows client. That was very exciting. We were very stoked about that announcement. How many of you have seen this chart? I mean, just check. We use this chart a lot. maybe a quarter of you have seen this chart. I just want to go through it really, really quickly because it kind of sets the context for what C++ CX is and what world it plays in. One of the things you'll find here is the world is kind of separated between the new on the left and the existing on the right, or you know, what's supported in Windows today, and Windows 7 is going to continue to be supported in Windows 8, which is desktop applications. For Metro-style applications, there's basically a few different ways that you can build Metro-style applications. One is you can use C++, or you can use C# or VB, and XAML, the XML-based markup language for declarative user interface. And you can use that to build Metro-style apps, Metro-style user interfaces. You can also use HTML, and from within HTML, you can interop to components that are written in C++ or C# or VB or whatever that surface their APIs through WinRT. WinRT is a brand new API surface area within Windows, brings with it a new ABI. It's based fundamentally on COM, kind of an updated, you know, COM whatever 0.0, an updated version of COM, if you will. But with C++ CX, a lot of the nasty internals are kind of hidden. You're not really worrying about query interfaces and add refs and release and idispatches and all the, you know, if you were a COM developer back in the day, you thought a lot about all that stuff, and you don't really think about that stuff anymore. Over on this side is kind of more traditional applications, kind of in their own stovepipe. And this isn't a full fidelity chart. So for example, one of the things I leave out here is DirectX. You can do DirectX in both places, both in Metro and in desktop, and you can build DirectX apps. And also, there's a limited subset of Win32 that is available in the Metro world as well. So again, not a full fidelity chart, but it kind of lays things out in as probably as simple a way as possible. So I talked about these three ways that you can build Metro-style applications. One of them is using XAML. So you combine your C++ code with some XAML code, and I'll show you just very briefly what that looks like. I'm doing a session tomorrow on building Metro-style apps in C++, so if you're really into that, come to my session tomorrow. I'll go very deep on that. The other is DirectX, and DirectX, you can even interop DirectX and XAML together for a pretty cool effect, and I have a little demo that at least shows you what that looks like and some of the things you can build with that. And then there's these hybrid applications, doing your user interface in HTML5, JavaScript, and then calling into WinRT components that are written in C++. And I'll go into deep detail on that again tomorrow if you want to check that out. But I just kind of wanted to make sure everybody was level set on, like, what is the platform? How do you do things on the platform? C++ CX, just a brief mention of what this is. So how many of you are familiar with C++ CLI, the .NET version? Okay. From a linguistic standpoint, it's almost identical to C++ CLI. So you have the little hat pointers and things like that, just like C++ CLI. But this talks to the WinRT Windows 8 world instead of to the COM world, or rather instead of to the .NET world, like C++ CLI. So it has its own type system, strongly typed for WinRT. It's a reference counting model. So add refs and releases are happening underneath the hood, although you don't have to worry about them when you're using C++ CX typically. Exceptions are supported in the model, so you do exception-based error handling, which is very nice. This is kind of the first, if you think about it, Win32 has been kind of error code returns as the method for handling errors in the operating system since the beginning of time. So it's nice to see exceptions as a part of the operating system API. Integrates really well with STL. I'll show you some of that in just a minute. And it provides for a well-defined binary contract between modules. So I can have WinRT components written in one language and WinRT components written in another language. Doesn't matter, native, managed. These talk to each other through WinRT very, very easily. I can even do parameterized types. You know, I can do generics functionally and have those interop with each other, which is not something that C++ does well, for example, across binaries. So let me show you a little bit here. Pop up Visual Studio. And I've left my computer by its lonesome for a while, so it's going to make me log in. Here we go. So this is Visual Studio. Oh, did it not switch over? Let's try that one more time. Ready, go. Okay, that's good. So there's Visual Studio. How many of you have seen Visual Studio 2012? Almost everybody has. Who likes the black? A handful of people. So it's weird. Back in my younger days, when I pretty much wrote code like 10 hours a day, I would always like set my entire IDE to black, because it just over time, like if you're staring at the screen all day, it works better. But I find it interesting that like black and all caps have been such polarizing aspects of the Visual Studio user interface. That tells me that people are very passionate about Visual Studio, which is good. Okay, so just want to show you really quickly a couple things in the IDE here. So what I've done is I'm just going to like do the new project template here. I've got a bunch of application choices that I can make. I'm going to do Windows Metro style just to kind of show you what this is all about. I'm going to choose a blank app. I'm just going to have it give me a blank designer here. So it's going to go ahead. It's going to generate an application for me. It's going to give me some sources, and it's going to create a whole bunch of boilerplate code for me that I don't really have to worry about. So I can come look at my main page code here. And so you see it gives me some event handlers built in. If I go to my main page, XAML, double click, it'll start to bring up the designer so that I can have an interactive designer. This is one of the points that I think is perhaps the coolest for C++. Like, finally, you have the same designer that everybody else has. It's the same for HTML5. It's the same for .NET. It's the same for C++. Like, everybody's sharing the same designer. It's good for us at Microsoft because we only have to write one thing and support all the languages, so we can like spend more of our time doing more things that are valuable. But I think it's good for you guys as well that can invest in learning one thing and scale that across multiple programming languages. So this, if I were to run this application, all this would be is just a blank Windows Metro page. I'm running Windows 8 on this laptop. It's not a fancy touchscreen laptop, but I do have Windows 8 installed. And that's the loading screen, and then after it finishes loading, I should see something that is fairly non-interesting, which is a blank Metro-style application. That's good. So I'll throw that away and come back. And let me just drop something. Let me drop something on here. So let's see here. Go to Toolbox, Common XAML Controls, and I'm just going to like drop a list view on here. Okay. There we go. I've dropped the list view. I'm going to give it a name. LV seems like a good name for a list view. Okay, let me go back to my sources here. So one of the things I wanted to show you guys is interoperability between C++ and C++ CX. I'm not going to go deeply into what is C++ CX, but you'll see those things on the screen and you go, yeah, that thing, that's not quite C++, and I'll say, yes, you're right, it's not. But it's C++ CX. So let me just include a header here. Yes, collection.h, because I'm going to play with some collections. So let me just type some C++ code here. So let's create a vector of... This is interesting. Let's create a vector of a C++ CX type, a string hat. Hat is a reference to a WinRT type. I used to do Pascal back in the day. I was a Delphi guy back in the day. So I always feel a little bit happy when I get to type the little caret pointer. Just happy memories. All right, so I'll create a little vector, and then we'll just add some stuff to the vector. How about one? See, this is the exciting part of the show. Live typing, always good. Okay, so we'll add just a bunch of strings here, just like this, just for fun. And let's see if this builds. Like, that's kind of the first test on did I screw anything up at this early stage. If it built, then... Okay, the build succeeded. So now what you know is it is possible to use an STL container type, a standard vector, to hold on to a WinRT type. And we've done a lot of work here to facilitate this kind of interop. What we recommend to folks, and I'll talk a little bit more about this tomorrow, but just very briefly, is you don't want to go crazy and like write your whole app in C++ CX. Like, that's not the recommendation. The recommendation is write it in standard C++. And then on the edges, where you have to interoperate with either the operating system or with another component or whatever, there you use C++ CX to create and consume WinRT. But within your application, you just use C++. And so we've done some other interesting things to facilitate interop. So let me create maybe another thing here. Let's use auto. That's a new thing, right? Now I don't have to know the type of anything, so now when you look at code, one, it's cleaner because I don't have type names everywhere, and then the other thing is you don't know what type anything is anymore. So that's kind of challenging. But that's okay. It works for the JavaScript guys, right? So let's say platform, :, collections, :. Ah, look, there's this other vector guy. So let's create one of these. I've got this other vector. And what I'd love to do is I would love to be able to just take that vector, that STL vector I created, and then instantiate one of these WinRT vectors, and then I can pass it around to other WinRT things. I think that should work. Just create it, pass it. Let's see. It doesn't quite like it. See, this is the part of kind of working without a net, doing some live coding. It's always a dangerous game. Let's see. All right. I'm going to do... There used to be this TV show starring this woman called Julia Child. And what she would do is she would show you how to bake a cake. And then while the thing was still in the bowl, she would turn to the oven and go, "Look, it's done. Look, it's done." Not sure what I did wrong there. Oh, I didn't do ref new. Oh, killed me. All right, wait. Should we try it? Let's try it. What do we have to lose? I forgot to new it. How can I forget that? That's such a rookie error. My goodness. There we go. So I don't new things. I ref new them because they're reference types. Let's see if the compiler likes that. I bet it does. What do you think? Yeah, okay, that's way better. Thanks. Okay. Now, another cool C++ 11 feature, like auto's great. My favorite is range-based for loops. Have you guys seen these? So one of the things I think is particularly painful to read in C++ is iterators, like begin, blah, 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 end, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you know, it's like this much code to do a very simple concept, which is kind of, for this type, do something for every one in that container. So I can do really cool things like this. I can say, figure out what type is inside of this vector. And for every one of those things, do something. So let's take each of those strings and let's add it. Let's add it like that. Okay, so let's see if this works. Yeah, so that works. Good. So I'm seeing, okay, I can mix this WinRT stuff and the standard C++ stuff. I'm seeing I can use C++ 11 features with all of this, so it's kind of very fluid. Let me just kind of emit a space here, so that we. And boom, boom. We'll just write a space so we can put some other stuff in here and then see what we're doing. So what would be cool is to go the other way. So now I've got this this WinRT collection, and I want to bring it back to an STL Connect collection. Okay, so let's see if it can figure out what the type is. We'll call it V2 equals to vector, and then we'll pass it VS. Okay, seems to be happy with that. So now I've gone back the other way. What would be interesting is if I could like use an STL function on these things. So let's do sort, and we'll do begin V2. In V2, so we'll sort it, and then we'll just kind of do this thing again and write it out. And except in this case, we'll do S2 and V2. How's that? Okay, let's see if this works. Okay, so that seems to work. I think it got alphabetical order correct, for the most part anyway. Okay, so good. So the only thing I wanted to show you guys there is like, yes, you can easily mix these platform things. You can mix them with the most modern language features. You can mix it with interoperating with your XAML for your user interface. So lots you can do in terms of using the platform programming language binding, C++ CX, with standard C++. I almost lost my clicker. All right, now let's talk a little bit about the experience realism that C++ enables, the expectation that users have of great user experience. So for C++, in a lot of ways, C++ isn't a good choice if you're kind of building a casual game or something like that. C++ is a more complex language, although it's certainly not as complex as it used to be. But it still tends to be a little bit more complex than some of the alternatives you could be using. And so we say, look, you use C++ when you really need something immersive, when you really need something high performance, when you really need a physics engine, when you really need DirectX and 3D graphics. In the latest Visual Studio, there's a whole bunch of new features that around supporting building games that are built on DirectX or building software that's built on DirectX. And I just want to quickly run through some of these because this is like a topic for a whole additional conference. So I don't want to drill deep, but I do want to let you guys know what's in here. So one is the ability to manage and edit images and 3D textures or textures for your games, 2D and 3D. For whatever your assets happen to be. There's actually a modern paint tool in Visual Studio now, which is kind of cool. Like we've had the kind of circa 1992 resource editor experience in Visual Studio for quite some time. So it's nice, like alpha channels and crazy things that have been around for 20 years that it's great that are finally supported in the IDE. The ability to do 3D models and meshes that represent 3D models and inspect industry standard model types, all this stuff is also built into Visual Studio as well in this release. Pixel shaders. We've got some support for graphically creating and then chaining together pixel shaders in Visual Studio. The ability to export those things to HLSL, which is the shader language that is used by DirectX. And the ability to show you how things in real time are going to be rendered. And then a graphics debugger, so that you can do kind of a historical playback of events. You know, you kind of have these problems when you're building these type of apps, like, oh man, that chunk of pixels isn't supposed to be purple. So let me click on those pixels and tell me what I did to get these things to be purple. The graphics debugging support in Visual Studio is designed to help you tackle that sort of problem. So one of the things I wanted to do quickly is just show you an example of an application that you can build when you sort of take the power of C++ and DirectX and apply it to this space. Let me see if I can get this thing up. Yes. Okay. So did it go away already? No, that's good. So this is an application we have that's called Journal. It's not something we're shipping. What we've basically done is taken a small part of the team offline for a while, and they're just focused on building this application. This application is all C++. It's actually a DirectX XAML app. So it uses this swap chain background panel, which is a root XAML element that you can use to interoperate between XAML Metro and DX. So we do all of our rendering. The whole 3D scene is rendered in XAML, although this doesn't look very 3D right now. But I can do some interesting things. So, for example, I can do a view, and I can look at all pages. And right now I've got one, but I can add more pages to my view. I can kind of zoom in on some of these pages like this. I should be able to. And this app is certainly not ready for prime time yet. So my apologies in advance if it goes south, and I'll try and restart it if it does. But it's pretty cool to see. So I'm painting with my finger right now. I'm using a touchscreen tablet here, and I'm just kind of painting with my finger. And look, he's very happy, but he's actually a vampire. I don't know why I do that. I amuse myself. I can zoom in. I don't know if you could see. It's very subtle, but I'm toggling on and off. You can see the lines thicken and thin. I'm toggling on and off. We do this dynamic smoothing of the lines. That's a computationally intensive algorithm that actually uses the vectorizer that's built into the compiler to make it go fast. So that's kind of a pretty neat feature I can kind of smooth. And we're trying to use all, like, the whole architecture is modern C++. It's STL. It's smart pointers. It's REII pattern everywhere. So we're trying to make it the kind of canonical modern C++ high-performance example. One of the things that I think is really cool about this app, let me see if I can re-enable touch here. There we go. So you notice I'm dragging my finger up and down the screen, and you notice that the page is bending in different places depending on where I'm dragging my finger. So this is very different, like a very different page flipping experience from, say, a typical phone app or tablet app where the thing is just a simple animation. This is not an animation. This is a physics simulation. When I move this and it's kind of curling the page, you can see a couple little artifacts there. For that, we're actually using C++ AMP and some vectorized loops in order to get really high performance around how the page should curl and deform, how the shadowing should be impacted when the page curls and forms. So all that stuff is happening dynamically in real time in, you know, handful of milliseconds. So very cool. Let's see if I can show you anything else that's... Oh, okay. So there are a couple of interesting tricks this app does. One is I can, I should be able to zoom in and out, yeah, with my finger here. That's kind of cool. The other interesting thing that this does is I can actually look at my 3D world. So there's the back of a piece of paper. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but there's actually nothing on the back of a piece of paper. So I can get this cool 3D, you know, I can kind of explore the 3D space here. I can, after I've explored the 3D space, I can do things like, let's do a wave effect on the paper, and that's kind of cool. Or, you know, that one's not funky enough, let's choose something that's way funkier. And then let's drag it around more and then kind of punish ourselves. And you kind of get seasick, actually, after a while when you're looking at this thing. But again, all kind of C++. We're doing a number of things we, you know, kind of where we can do things asynchronously, we do. Where we can do things parallel, we do. All of that uses PPL, the Parallel Pattern Library, for asynchrony and for parallelism. Ultimately, we're hoping to be able to make the source code available so that folks can take this and go, okay, how do I take all these C++ concepts you're telling me about and put it in one app and do something that's kind of cool and compelling? And so that's essentially what we're aiming for here. Let's see. I think that's the extent of all the cool stuff I'm hoping to show you. So let me switch back over here. Okay. There we go. And by the way, the demo gods were totally smiling on me because this app was crashing as of like an hour ago. And I got through the whole demo without crashing, which is extremely exciting if you're me. All right, so I talked a lot about things we were doing to leverage the hardware and kind of an immersive experience here. So I just want to say a few more words about hardware and some of the things we're doing in this space. One is just to like put ourselves in context in terms of hardware evolution. So from kind of the mid-70s to early 2000s, this was actually Microsoft's mission statement at one time, to put a computer on every desk, in every office, and in every home. And like, okay, check, you know, mission accomplished. Computers are everywhere. In fact, computers are more than everywhere. They're kind of a problem now. You can't go anywhere without a smartphone and a computer staring you in the face. But then the free lunch ended, sequential performance started to hit a plateau due to heat and power constraints. And so then the goal was like, until recently, like, okay, we need to like put a parallel supercomputer on every desk. Like everything needs to be highly parallel. We need to keep offering performance in a similar power and heat envelope at a similar cost. And so that's been since the free lunch ended in the mid 2005 era. That's kind of what we've been working on. And now we're kind of in this, in many ways, it's a hardware jungle. So now we have heterogeneity to worry about. Like, it's not just our CPU. Now people are thinking, well, we have these GPUs that are very efficient for compute, and I want to leverage that capability. I've got all this power on this particular piece of hardware, and I want it all. Like, I don't just want a little bit of it. I want all the power my computer can deliver. When I build a modern app, I also want to leverage the cloud, and I want to build some stuff that leverages what's out there in the cloud and helps me use it better. So now like there's crazy stuff going on in hardware, and C++ is, we're here to help. So a couple of things we've done on the kind of single machine focus. One is automatic loop vectorization. I'll tell you more about that in a second. We've done some improvements to the parallel patterns library, and I have a demo I can show you quickly on that one. We now support the ARM architecture. So ARM is what the Windows RT tablets will run. How many saw the Surface announcement? Very exciting announcement. One of the devices they demonstrated was running Windows RT on an ARM CPU. And so that's built into our compiler now as well. We brought up that entire architecture this release. General purpose GPU computing or accelerated data parallelism with C++ AMP. And then we've done a bunch of stuff around debugging and profiling in this release to kind of keep up with all of that stuff. So how many of you are familiar with vectorization and what vectors are? Couple people. It's actually a really fancy word for a really simple topic. This graphic kind of demonstrates very simply what it is. With scalar code, you kind of have two operands, like two integers, say you want to add them or multiply them. It's like operand one, operand two, go. And that happens in one cycle, right? That happens in one cycle on your computer. What vectorization does is it says, well, actually, like I've got my registers are pretty wide. I can do more than hold one integer. In fact, I can hold four of them, or maybe eight of them, or maybe 16 of them. I can have a lot of them. And if you want to perform the same operation on all of them, I can do all of them in one cycle. So this becomes really valuable when you start to look at loops that traverse matrices or arrays, where maybe you want to do something similar to every element of a particular array or matrix. You can get good performance gains. A simple algorithm where you add one to every element of an array, and you put that in a loop, you can, if you have a four-wide vectorization built into the compiler, it can cut the time it takes to traverse that loop by, it can make it 25% of what it was, because it can do four at a time. So kind of looks like this. I've got this thing where I'm adding two arrays together. On the left, you see what a scalar version of that would look like. On the right, you see kind of some pseudocode for what this would be in the vector world. But basically, it's this idea that I'm doing four things at a time in one clock cycle to produce one result. This happens automagically. You don't necessarily have to know what's happening. You don't have to care. If you do care, there's some things you can do to kind of figure out if your loop is being vectorized or not. But essentially, it's an optimization that just kicks in when the compiler detects that it's safe to do and possible to do. So the whole goal here is, for years we've had the blue part we were able to use. We were able to use the scalar unit really effectively. But look at all the real estate that Intel and AMD devote to the vector units. They devote like almost the same amount of real estate to vector units. And for years, with our compiler, you weren't really able to use that part of the hardware very effectively at all. So our goal is simply like, let's make those blue too. Like, there's a lot of real estate there that's valuable and can help performance. Let's use it. PPL is about task parallelism, not data parallelism. So it's this idea that in addition to loop vectorization, I can create tasks and I can compose these tasks together for parallel work. One of the ways I like to think about it is threads are such a horrible abstraction to think at as a developer. Threads are really how the hardware needs to think about this kind of thing, right? Threads are threads of execution. They happen in the hardware. They've all got their own instruction pointer, blah, blah, blah. They've all got their own stack, and they're all doing their own thing. But that's not how we think about the work in our software. In our software, we think about, well, this component needs to perform this task, and this component needs to perform this task, and maybe they can happen independent of one another, or maybe there's a dependency. This needs to happen before this. But you're thinking in terms of chunks of work. And that's what tasks allow you to do, is to break your software down into chunks of work and then declaratively state dependencies between these things. So yeah, this can go happen asynchronously or in parallel. And when it's done, go do these other things. We also have a bunch of other things to support this model. Algorithms and containers, kind of STL-like support for working in a parallel world. One of the things I'd like to focus on, though, is this kind of thing. So if I want to compose two pieces of parallel work, I can create a task called A, and I can have it go do something. And then when task A is done, I could simply say A.then, And then in this case, I'm using lambda expressions to pass some more code. So both A and this then continuation can be parallel, execute off the GUI thread, whatever. But there's an explicit ordering that gets enforced by the runtime. And I can do something more than sort of these linear chains. They can actually be complicated graphs. I can do choice and join. So I can say, actually, I want T to happen when T1 or T2 have happened. So either or I want T to happen when both T1 and T2 have happened. So you can kind of see where this leads. I can show you a quick example of this in Visual Studio. All right, so let me open up a little demo here. One of the things I really appreciate about the latest release of Visual Studio is it comes up much faster than years past. So let's take a problem that you might have that this can be applied to. For example, let's say I'm building a build system, C++ build system, which has dependencies. This project needs to be built before this one because maybe it uses a DLL or a lib file or something, OBJ, that the other one requires. Let's say I was using threads to write that code. So I would, in this case, I've got four projects, A, B, C, and D. If I was using threads, maybe I'd spin up four threads or four chunks of work in a thread pool, and then, gosh, maybe I'd use a semaphore, and on the semaphore, I can signal when A and B get done, and then I can wait for that signal in the dependent things, and when I see that signal, then I can go ahead and, you're starting to visualize. This becomes a lot of code. You've got thread procs everywhere. What you've really done is you've tuned your code to how the operating system thinks or how the hardware thinks about parallelism, and you really lose context as to what's happening, linear flow in your code. So this is how this would look with more linear flow in my code. I've got these four projects, and I create two tasks, task A, task B, and they build A and B. So you can see that project C needs to have A built first, and project D needs to have both A and B built first. So I've got a little graph there. So I build those things. So I build C after A. That's pretty easy. I can just say, A dot then, do B. Pretty straightforward. And then if I want to build D, I can just say, D builds after both A and B are completed. And let me get rid of the tooltip. So if you're using a threaded programming model or something else, what would be a lot of code that would then be very difficult to untangle and understand the complexity becomes something that's very easy to understand and read. It's kind of human readable. And I'm not dealing with locks and semaphores and mutexes and all this stuff that is really error prone. If you've had to do a lot of multi-threaded code, you know that a lot of times that stuff is hard for geniuses to get right. Okay, so I just wanted to give you a quick preview of that. Now let's talk a little bit about C++ AMP. So C++ AMP provides support for heterogeneous platforms. I can do both CPU and, in this release, it's GPU based on DirectX 11, although the language piece of this can work on top of anything. The language piece isn't specific to DirectX. It's not even specific to Microsoft. Kind of very palatable to being used in a really general case. It's built into VS in this release of the product, built right into Visual Studio, there's debugging support for it. It's kind of a whole, what you would expect for a language feature in Visual Studio, it's all there, it's all supported. We provide some STL-like support for dealing with multidimensional data and for automatically marshalling your data to and from the GPU, which is something that often has to happen, you have to do yourself, depending on what kind of programming model that you're using. And the idea here is, one, it's really about enabling developers to get performance. That's why they want to do this kind of GPU stuff is, hey, there's this untapped well of performance. Let me go tap it. Then it's also about productivity. I know C++. I'm good at C++. Wouldn't it be great if I could use C++ on my GPU instead of dropping to some low-level C programming model or some API-based thing? And then finally, portability. This works for any DirectX 11 piece of hardware. So I don't need vendor XYZ's graphics card. If it's a DX11 card, it works. That's on our back end. On the front end, again, the language piece is designed to be portable to any hardware, any operating system, whatever. And in fact, we've released an open specification on the language piece, which looks like this, so that, hey, if you're a compiler vendor sitting in the audience and you would like to implement C++ AMP, you can go get this open spec. We also offer some conformance tests that you can run to make sure you're conforming to the spec and, you know, you're off to the races. So for C++ AMP, let me quickly go over some of the elements here. At its core, the core thing is this parallel for each, which is this guy. And that's the thing that indicates, okay, this parallel for each loop, this is the loop that I want to run, that I want to accelerate. I've got some helper things, like I've got extent that describes the shape of the data that I want to go iterate on. It could be a multi-dimensional array, for example. The key piece about this parallel for each that tells it to go use C++ AMP to execute is this restrict AMP clause that is being used to decorate the lambda expression. So that tells the compiler two things. One, it says generate C++ AMP code for the body of this loop. And two, restrict what can be done inside of this loop to only the subset of C++ that is supported by AMP, that is supported by DX11. So for example, there are no bytes on a GPU. GPUs don't have byte data types. So you can't use a byte inside of this thing as just one example of a restriction. But the important point is that it's not a different language. It's not a separate thing. It's a subset of normal C++. We've got these classes called array views that wrap the data that lives out on the CPU and main memory, automatically marshal it into the GPU for operation, then back out again. So that's what you see here with array views. And that's kind of the quick, fast tour of C++ AMP. I'll show you a demo of some of the performance gains that you can expect. We also have a bunch of knobs that that's kind of the naive case. If you really want to tune to the hardware, you'll want to do something called tiling take the best advantage of data layout and locality. There's also some cache that lives on the device that you can take advantage of if you want to, again, optimize for performance. Kind of an advanced topic. We won't cover it here. Kate will probably talk about this in her session, Kate Gregory. She'll do a whole big session on C++ AMP. What I'd like to do is just the fun stuff, though. I want to show you what this thing looks like. So let's open up a project. So what this project is this project morphs one face into another. My apologies. Let me switch over. And it does get confusing, I must say. So many buttons. I'm a software guy. Okay, so I've got this thing. This is actually a C-sharp skin, and then the core imaging algorithm is built into a C++ DLL. So it's an example of native managed interop. So what this does, I don't know, has anybody seen us do this demo, the Tom Cruise, Tomcat demo? We've done it, a couple people in the audience have seen it. Kind of morphs one face. We got tired of that one, so we're morphing this lady's face into this guy's face. And there are a couple ways we do this, just to kind of demonstrate. I can, for example, set the processing mode to sequential and click morph, and then let me choose an output directory where it drops the intermediate images. And so what you'll see here is very slow change on the morph because it's a very computationally intensive algorithm. And you can see I'm using very little of my CPU, 14% of my CPU. Can I say that I really like the new task manager in Windows 8? Would that be making me a fanboy? But I really do like the new task manager. Okay, so this is going to take forever. I'm not going to make you all sit through while we sit here and wait for this to complete. Let me do this. Let me switch this now to PPL. And now let me click morph. So now I'm going to use PPL to generate a bunch of tasks. And what I should see is good saturation of my CPUs. Now it's going to engage all of my cores. This is a four physical core machine with eight logical threads. So you see I'm using them all. I'm going crazy. Still pretty slow because, again, it's very computationally intensive, this algorithm. So I really don't even want to wait for this. I'm gonna cancel this one too. What I'm now going to do is I'm gonna set processing mode to C++ AMP, and when I do that, it will run this computation kernel on my GPU. It'll put the data on my GPU and run this kernel on my GPU as a compute job. So let me click morph, choose an output device, and two things you should observe. One, wow, it's fast. Two, CPU. So it's not only that that it's going faster, it's that I'm not utilizing my CPU. So I could run a GPU and a CPU version of this at the same time and kind of get the benefits. So there we go. That's the wonderful world of C++ AMP and some of the performance gains that you can expect. Now, what you'll find in practical terms is if you have data parallel code that is well factored, the loops are well factored so that our vectorizer can vectorize those loops, and you're making them parallel, you're not going to get like the 50x, 100x speedups that sometimes people talk about with GPUs. You'll probably get something more on the order of 2 to 5x, depending on what the workload looks like and what the data looks like and all of that. So it's modest compared to like these order of magnitude plus speedups that people see with GPUs over kind of bad sequential code. But if it's vectorized and parallelized, the gain isn't that much. But hey, like twice as fast is twice as fast, right? Sometimes we fight for 5%, 10% more performance, and getting something to be twice as fast is there's a lot of virtue in that. So really quickly, I just wanted to hit on some of the productivity stuff that's happening in the C++ world. C++ 11 standard, we've talked a little bit about that already. And the IDE and tool chains have really improved in the C++ space. One of the realizations that we've had in the C++ world, it's really more important to finish something at high quality than to kind of get to the first check-in. And so talk more about that here. This is a quote from Andrei Alexandrescu, who is, he currently works at Facebook, but he's kind of a C++ wonk. He's kind of Mr. Template. And it's a very well-worded statement, but let me paraphrase this statement. With C++, you can get to done faster. That is, I have a problem I want to solve within a performance envelope, within a memory envelope. I've got constraints on how I want to solve this problem. With C++, I can get there faster. With another language, I can probably get to the first check-in faster. And then I will spend a lot more time trying to meet my performance envelope, trying to meet my memory envelope, trying to wonder why the GC is kicking in when I don't want the GC to kick in, whatever. This is some of the realization that's happening. One of the drivers for C++ is it's like, wow, some of the gains that I thought I was getting, productivity gains that I thought I was getting with other languages, may not always be there. Sometimes they are. You should always use the highest level language that you can possibly get away with. But sometimes it's not the case. Sometimes those gains really aren't there. So just to show you, and Kate Gregory's doing a session on modern C++ where she'll talk some more about this. But this just shows you like the differences between someone was calling this your father's C++. And then I thought, you know, that's kind of offensive because that's like my C++, not my. But anyway, so we saw auto earlier, automatic type deduction. You could see that I can use make shared instead of shared putter, so I can get rid of some of the crufty syntax and make it a little bit more easy to read. I'm using stack semantics here, so I can get rid of all my deletes, and I could stop worrying about like memory leaking if an exception gets thrown. It's all exception safe, so that's all good. And you saw me earlier use range-based for loops, so you can see another example of that here. So it just like these two codes functionally do exactly the same thing. 10 years ago, we would have looked at that code on the left and went, that's modern C++, well done. You can't read it, but it's modern C++. We've done a bunch of things in the ALM space, too, in C++. So we've added a whole bunch of new ALM features, and Rong Liu, who works on our team, did a session on this, which you can find in the recording if you weren't there. But there's a whole bunch of new C++ support. For a long time, C++ was lagging in terms of ALM support within Visual Studio for our language. Now it's not quite the same level as .NET languages, but it's getting there. So some things we've improved code analysis, we've improved code coverage. Code analysis is actually available in the Express version of the product now, so you can get static analysis in the Win 8 Desktop Express. Some new architecture tools that work with C++, and of course unit testing now for C++. So a whole bunch of new things to help developer productivity in the workflow. Whole bunch of new stuff in Visual Studio that works great for all languages. I won't drill into these, but you'll find them if you use Visual Studio 2012. But there's a bunch of new things for C++ as well. Some of those you probably saw as I was typing, around reference highlighting, around better semantic colorization, so I can see like strings from enums, from whatever, and a bunch of code editing enhancements. C++ IntelliSense is back. Like, it disappeared for a version of the product. Sorry, my bad. But now it's back, so we're friends again. And things like, you know, the IntelliSense member list can automatically pop up. We've kind of licked those performance problems. Member list gets filtered automatically. We finally have code snippets. So just, modern stuff, modern IDE stuff is now applicable to C++. One last topic I want to hit on with you guys in my 9 minutes and 10 seconds remaining is what's next. And one of the things we're doing is this project called Casablanca, which is about the cloud. It's about making C++ an effective language and an effective in cloud environments. So Casablanca does a few things. It enables clients. Client in this context can be code that's running on an actual client or even on a server that's consuming REST services. You can write REST services with Casablanca. You can compose these things together asynchronously, so under the hood, everything is tasks. It's all PPL-based with Casablanca, so it's the code is kind of nice, easy to read, asynchronous, lots of .thens, you know, go do this asynchronously, .then when it's done, go do this other thing with the answer. And then we're doing kind of more incubation-y thing. We've got this actor design pattern that's in PPL today, that we're trying to move and make be able to do actors across different machines. And so that's present in the current DevLabs release of Casablanca. The previous slide, I did have a link. And just last night, we updated this link, by the way, with a new version that works on Visual Studio RC. So you'll definitely want that if you're interested. Just want to show you a couple things really quickly. So let me switch over machines again. There we go. Okay. So let me show you just a couple examples of where we make things easy. Go for it. So one of the things that's pretty difficult in C++ is writing a server, you know, listening on a socket, kind of getting some data. Node.js does this really, really well. If you've ever tried to do this in C++ using something like HTTP sys, it's a lot of code, a lot of boilerplate. These 1, 2, 3, 4 lines of code, that's a server. 4 lines of code. This isn't like a commercial ready, like, I'm not saying go out and write like web servers that look like this. Like, you still probably want to integrate with like IIS or something. You still want to care about access control and, all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm not making a statement that you don't want to care about that. But what I am saying is it doesn't have to be that hard. Like, when you have a modern programming model with C++ 11, you notice the use of lambda expressions here. When you have the ability to operate asynchronously with tasks, you can really kind of get a nice programming model in C++ that does something that used to be fairly complicated. So in this case, this is a server. Let me go ahead and run this. And this just fires up a little console that sits here and kind of listens on a port. And then while this is sitting there doing its thing, I'll just open up another project. And this one will be a client. All right, so here's my HTTP client. And as I look at the code, I've got a bunch of boilerplate code here that really is just about controlling the user interface. I'd like to take you to the piece of code that matters. Really, there are just a couple blocks of code that matter. One is the thing that sends the request, and one is the thing that handles the request. And so you see here, this is packaging up the request using JSON serialization to serialize my code using JSON like I would for a REST service. Sends an HTTP GET to a server, gets a response. You can see the request.then down here below. When I request.then, when I get this response, sort of unpack the response, deserialize it, and then display it. This happens to be a Metro-style application. So if I do a GET, for example, so this should be the server that I have running in the background on port 4711. If I click Submit, seems to work okay. So that's all good. Let me switch back. There we go. So within Casablanca, just want to do the full build here. Essentially, we're building on PPL. We're building on I/O completion ports on WinHTTP, like all the things in the operating system and in our runtime. Casablanca has libraries that support all the purple stuff, you know, JSON and HTTP and TCP listening and et cetera, asynchronous I/O. And then we provide a couple domain libraries within that world. One is a C++ actors library. The other is a set of wrappers for all the Azure services. We don't have them all implemented yet, but I think we have blobs, queues, and tables, if I'm not mistaken. Certainly blobs and queues implemented in the download today. So if you want to go build some C++ stuff that integrates well with Azure, you could do that today with the download. You can imagine other things could be built, and that's the light blue here. Really, it's three scenarios we're trying to solve for. One is I want to build a client. Two is I want to build a performance-intensive service. So maybe it's some kind of signal processing thing or a game or whatever on the cloud. And the other is I have a server app that is designed to run on an on-premises server, and I want to move that to the cloud. And in doing so, I need to care a lot more about asynchronously and failover and blah, blah, blah. And because a lot of these traditional server apps are written in C++ or C, Casablanca is a great choice to help make that transition from a server to a service running in the cloud. So that's it. I have 3 minutes left, and I'd be happy to take questions if you guys have any. Someone asked the Windows XP question earlier. Yes, sir.
What about MFC? Does it still get some love, or is it basically?
Will MFC continue to get love? Yes. In fact, a couple days ago, we posted an entry on our blog that listed all the user-reported MFC bugs that we fixed in this release, and there were a ton of them. So continuing to evolve MFC, when you come to me and say, hey, I want to build a desktop app in C++, my answer to you is you should do that in MFC. Like that's the way you do it. That's the framework we provide to do that. If you want to build Metro, you should do XAML, do HTML5. But MFC is still there, still works, still supported, still loved. Yes? Yes, sir?
I mean, like the app stuff, but it seems industry is separated from OpenCL. How do you plan to do that?
So is your question, there's this AMP OpenCL. Specifically, what are you curious about that dynamic? Plans for Visual Studio to better support OpenCL. We don't have any plans in the books right now to better support OpenCL. So for those of you unfamiliar with the GPU space, two programming models that are popular today for GPUs, one is CUDA, which is kind of an NVIDIA thing, works on their hardware. The other is OpenCL, which is, from a programming model standpoint, designed to be independent of hardware vendor or even hardware, the kind of hardware. Different vendors have kind of slightly different variations of this. And then we have C++ AMP, which comes in at a sort of a different level of abstraction, different value proposition. What I would personally love to see is I would personally love to see somebody take C++ AMP and generate OpenCL out of the back end. It's not It wouldn't be difficult, and if somebody wanted to do that, we would help them. We probably won't do it. Like, we like the solution we have with DX. If we look at, like, what is the next highest priority for us after a great DX implementation, I would probably say we'd like to go to SSE4 or AVX code gen so it works even if you don't have a GPU at all. That would probably be our next set of priorities, but I would love for somebody else to come along and we'd work with them. Yeah. Did you have a question? Okay. Yes, sir.
One point you said that for error exceptions are coming from the operating system and adaptive kind of things. What kind of exceptions? What structured exceptions like
the... Yeah, it's different than C++ exceptions. So the question is, like, I mentioned that exceptions are now a part of the operating system. You can expect things to get thrown. I'll talk a little bit more about exceptions tomorrow. It's not C++ SEH. But it's built in. The closest analogy would probably be the .NET exception model. Yes. Make sure. One more question. Yes.
What about existing Go and C++ CLI in the desktop environment?
Existing C++ CLI continues to work fine. We haven't made another push into C++ CLI. We think it's in a good space. We fixed some bugs there. We got the syntax highlighting back in, so we did make some investments in making sure that the developer experience was better than it was in the last version. But there wasn't a lot of new work for us to do in that space, so we didn't do any in this release. But certainly, if you want to build a desktop app and you want to use .NET and C++ CLI as your way to get to .NET, definitely. Still supported. Yes. And I'm out of time, so what I want to do is thank you guys. If you have more questions... I'm going to pack up and then I'll head to the back of the room. But please enjoy the rest of the conference, and I hope to see you around.